I am Steve Gerwick, the webmaster of Gerwick.net. That's www.gerwek.net. And this is time. It's a pleasure to welcome to the website a true wrestling legend, known for many gimmicks, which we'll talk about in the interview. Tonight I give you none other than the former member of Demolition as Demolition Smash, Crusher Khrushchev, you may remember from back in the day, and we'll get into all these gimmicks. Tonight I give you Barry Darso. How you doing tonight, Barry?
Good, Steve. Can't complain.
Great.
And good to talk to you.
It's a pleasure talking to you, and as I was telling Barry, you know, before we started the interview, that I really probably remember you from the very beginning of your career, or almost at the beginning of your career with the Crockett days. I guess let's just kind of start from the beginning. You know, I just read Road Warrior Animal's book, talking about the good old days of training with Eddie Sharkey, and then I think you, along with Road Warrior Animal, were bouncers. So what was it like training with Eddie Sharkey and maybe that makeshift school that he had back in the day?
Well, what was funny, it was Animal, myself, Hawk, Rick Rude, and, you know, Scott Norton and Al Blake. We had about, you know, 10 of us guys, and John Norton, Wayne Bloom. We all kind of worked at the same bar. And Eddie Sharkey was a bartender there. And we used to throw guys out the front door and have contests to see how far they'd fly. And Eddie Sharkey wow. would come running out and look at us, and he'd say, Jesus Christ, I got to get you guys into wrestling. And we always thought, yeah, sure, Eddie, you can't get us into wrestling. And then one day he says, hey, I'm going to have a camp, and, you know, I want you guys to come down there. So Hawk, Animal, myself, and Rick Rude, we all came down to the camp, and it was in a church basement. And it was an old boxing ring with nails coming up out of the wood and, you know, the ropes. You couldn't hit the ropes or anything. And Eddie had the camp right there. And that was the start of it all. Eddie came through.
And as I remember from the Road Warrior Animal book, Eddie was working in the club as a bartender at the time, right?
Right. He was the bartender.
Right.
And when we'd throw the guys out the door, he'd follow us right out, and he'd watch us throw the guys right out the door. And he would just laugh.
That was quite a camp, you know, with the Road Warriors, yourself, and Rick Rude. I mean, when you guys started training, I mean, you know, you were kind of nonchalant, and yeah, sure, Eddie, you know, whatever. But I mean, what was your dreams at that point? I mean, you guys were working obviously very hard as in the bar. What was your goal, or what did you really want to accomplish in wrestling?
Well, before all that took place, you know, Kurt Hennig. I grew up with Kurt Hennig, and you know, I used to train with him at the gym way back, and I used to always ask him, when are you going to get into wrestling? He was just a skinny little kid, and he never really thought he was going to get in. And then after we were training, you know, lifting weights, and he started getting stronger and growing, he said, you know, I think I'm going to talk to my dad. Well, his dad always told him, no way, you're not getting in this business. And I kept pushing Kurt, you got to get in the business. So finally, he ended up going to Vern Gagne's wrestling camp, and he got in. And it was at that time, they only took so many people in Vern's camp, and he was very lucky to get in there. And when he got in there, he got into wrestling, and after seeing him in there, then that kind of really got my eye, you know, hey, I want to get into wrestling too, you know, and talking to Kurt and everything. So it was kind of like, you know, if Kurt can do it, we can do it. And that's when Eddie came up with the idea of getting into wrestling. We thought, well, shoot, let's go through Eddie instead of waiting in line to go to Vern's camp. And, you know, that's how we got in. So it was kind of a, you know, after watching as a kid, watching Larry Hennig and the Crusher and the Bruiser and Baron Von Raschke and everything, it was, you know, you always thought, boy, wouldn't it be great to be able to do that, get into wrestling, and never, you know, never thought that it would ever happen. But the opportunity was there, and we took it.
I didn't know that about Kurt Hennig. Obviously, was a second generation wrestler with Larry the Axe Hennig, and of course we've seen so many second generation wrestlers, you know, the Kaniskis, the Ganyas. So it seems odd that you know, obviously when you kind of grow up in the business, it's totally different than when you kind of break into the business as a singles guy. But Was it Larry that didn't want him to get into wrestling? And it seems surprising since, you know, it's like, you know, Kurt was like such a natural professional wrestler.
Yeah, but, you know, you got to think back when he first started, you know, he was just a skinny little kid.
Right.
And, you know, you look at Larry, Larry's a 300-pound monster, you know, one of the strongest guys around. He's looking at his little kid. You know, it's kind of like how I look at my kid now. You know, he's wrestling now. And it's, you know, to me, he's still my kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm watching him over a couple of years, how good he's getting. It's like, you know, hey, this kid's going to make it. And when he first started, I thought, you know, it's the stupidest thing. Don't get into wrestling. But, you know, now after, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of, you know, working in the indie show and doing all this stuff and everything, he's turning out to be a heck of a wrestler.
Yeah, we'll talk about Dakota towards the end of the interview because I got some questions about your son there. And, you know, you were talking about, you know, at the time Kurt was, you know, kind of a puny kid. And I remember, you know, when Greg Gagne came along, that people thought, you know, this is such a skinny little guy that they're not going to take this guy seriously. But, I mean, if the guy can work and he can really wrestle and entertain, you know, people will buy into him.
Exactly. And then just, you know, with Kurt maturing, you know, then all of a sudden, you know, he started, you know, winning on TV and started, you know, getting bigger and stronger and looking the part better and everything. And then all of a sudden his dad is thinking, you know, hey, this kid can make it. And then all of a sudden Larry started helping him, you know. But it's like, you know, it's hard to see your kid in there getting beat up and getting hurt and, you know, but you got to let it go.
Did you get a chance to read Road Warrior Animal's book?
I got to read parts of it, he did a really good job in that book.
How does it feel like, you know, they're talking about you? You know, they got all these stories, and I remember there's one story about you guys traveling in a car, you know, packing the car together, make these long trips. How does it feel like to kind of read about yourself after all these years?
Well, you know, there's so much out there and everything. It's just kind of neat to read something where one of your friends wrote a book in there, you know. You really appreciate him. He's a great guy. And, you know, it's just kind of neat that he thought of me to even put me in the book. You know what I mean?
Right. You know, you broke in with the Road Warriors, and you said Rick Rude, as, you know, chronicled in Road Warrior Animal's book. I just was curious, how did those guys change since the Eddie Sharkey days?
Like, what do you mean change?
I mean over the years, you know, once they got into wrestling, as they got some success, did they change, or did they kind of seem like the same guys that you remember from back in the gym?
Well, they were always the same guys. You know, like when, you know, one of the greatest things was getting in the ring and wrestling them after starting off with them, and then, you know, eventually you have matches with them and everything. And it was just like being back in Eddie's camp. You know, it's, you know, you kind of change to the way you act around people because it's a persona you're putting on, but when you're with your buddies and your friends and everything, you're always the same.
One thing I always like to ask, and of course your son's different because his father was a great wrestler, but what was the perception like, you know, when you told your parents, you know, hey, I'm going to try this professional wrestling thing? What was their kind of reaction to that?
Well, my mom thought I was absolutely nuts, but she backed me all the way. You know, she helped me out a lot. You know, I had to call from on the road a lot of times and say, hey, Mom, I'm out of money. Can I borrow another 100 or can I borrow 500? And, you know, she was always there for me, which was huge. And I can remember the first trip I went on, when I first started, I left Eddie's camp and I flew to Hawaii and wrestled there for, Leah Maivia. And, I was promised that, you know, I was going to make $1 million and all this. And I got there and they had one show a month. And to live in Hawaii for a whole month, it gets pretty expensive.
Right.
So I had to call home and say, hey, Mom, can I borrow about $1,000 here so I can live? And, you know, that's what helped me go from Hawaii to New Zealand to, you know, Samoa and Tonga and all that. And then I met, you know, all the different people. And when I was in New Zealand, I spent 3 weeks with, you know, Ric Flair there. And he helped me out a lot. And, you know, it just kind of, that's how it all works, you know.
Yeah, when I was reading Road Warrior Animals book 2, there was one scenario where he went down south, you know, was working for a while, and then just didn't work out, and he went back home to Minnesota, and it kind of looked like at that point that maybe, you know, wrestling was going to be behind him, he's going to have to move on to something else. Did you ever get to that point where you said, well, I don't know if this is going to work out?
No, you know, I never got to that point, because I knew that, you know, I thought to myself that I had a talent, and if it was just the right situation, I was going to make it. And I was willing to drive anywhere around the country. And back then, there was territories in every town, and all I needed to do was get on TV. And then I knew either the people were going to hate me or like me. And I can remember when Animal came back from that. He was in North Carolina, and he came back, and he said, this is the worst thing I've ever done. And I remember, you know, Animal was about 280 pounds back then, you know, built unbelievable. And Johnny Weaver, who was probably 55, 60 years old back then, put him in the sleeper and beat him, you know. And Joe came home with his tail between his legs, and we're all at the camp, and he says, guys, he goes, I just get beat by a 60-year-old guy with the sleeper. He says, I think I'm done in this business. And we all laughed, you know, but Johnny Weaver was the biggest thing down there, you know.
Right. Right.
I mean, that's like Vern Gagne up here, you know.
Sure, yeah.
So, but then it ended up being where Ole Anderson came down to camp and took him and Hawk and made them the Road Warriors, and that was it.
What do you think the biggest lesson, or what was the most important lesson you learned from Eddie Sharkey?
You know, that was one good thing. Eddie was very smart about the business. And, you know, at camp, you know, he showed us the moves and everything, but he taught us how to, you know, be with other wrestlers and other people. Because it's more than just wrestling in the ring. It's how you treat, you know, the older guys back then. When we were young, it was respect. And it was, you know, this guy's been in the business for 10 years, and we just started. You respect him. It's no, sir, yes, sir. You know, and he taught you to sit in the dressing room, and you don't talk, you listen. And that's where you're going to learn and you're going to grow. And that's where Eddie was really good.
How did you get started with the Crockett promotion?
I was down with Bill Watts, and I was there for about a year and a half, and I really learned how to wrestle when I was down there. And I became Crusher Khrushchev down there. I was partners with Nikolai Volkov. And it was my time to leave there, and I went to the Florida territory, and I wrestled for Eddie Graham there. And me and Jim Neidhart were partners down there. And after about 6 months there, Nikita called me up, and he said, Barry, he says, we need you up here in Charlotte. And I said, I'm not leaving Florida, because I was making really good money in a home every night there. And I said, you know, I need a certain amount of money if I'm going to come. And he says, well, I'm going to have Dusty give you a ring then. So Dusty was the booker there, and that territory at that time, Crockett's territory, was way down. They didn't have hardly any TVs or anything, so the guys were starving to death there. And Dusty called me up, and he says, Barry, he says, I want you to come up to Charlotte. And I said, Dusty, I can't. You know, I got a guarantee here in Tampa. You know, I can't make what you're making. And he says, well, I just want you to know, I really want you to come. And I said, well, I'll think about it. Well, then Flair came in, and he used to wrestle in Tampa and Orlando and everything. And Flair called me up and says, Barry, you got to come. He says, I'm going to bring you and Arn in. I need you guys in here. And he says, I promise you, you will make money. He says, well, When you come into Charlotte, we're going to build this territory. We're going to get new TVs and everything. And so then ended up calling Dusty again. I said, Dusty, I'm coming in. So I left Florida, and then that's how that all started in Charlotte. And when we first started wrestling there, it was, you know, Nikita and Ivan were there, and then I was the third one that came in, and I became really partners with Ivan because Nikita was kind of getting off into singles. And there was probably, you know, 300, 400 people in the building, in all the buildings we were wrestling in. And then as the TVs started, you know, showing on, you know, Sunday morning or Saturday nights or whatever it was there, pretty soon the next time around there was 600 people in all the towns. Then pretty soon 1,000 people in all the towns. And then all of a sudden we started making our money, you know. And it became a great territory, but boy, there were some long trips. Oof.
Actually, you know, a lot, you know, I remember you obviously as Crusher Khrushchev, but a little known fact is you actually wrestled as Crusher Darso in Mid-South,
yeah.
Correct?
Yeah, I was, I kind of started off in Atlanta. I was Man Mountain Darso, and I carried an axe around, and I was actually partnered with Stan Hansen, and we went against
wow.
the Road Warriors down there. And then that's when I met Arn Anderson down there. Me and Arn partnered up a little bit down there. And then Ole, you know, and at that time, wrestling was huge in Atlanta. That was on WTBS. And, you know, all the top stars were there. And Ole pulled me aside. And, you know, he was friends with Eddie Sharkey, and I met him in camp before. So I already had a relationship with Ole. So Ole pulled me aside and he says, Barry, he says, I'm going to send you out of here. You're too good of a talent to waste with all these people here. He says, I'm going to send you down to Mid-South wrestling with Bill Watts and you're going to really learn how to wrestle. And he said, and he's the toughest promoter. He's the most brutal, but, you're going to learn. So I got in my car and I drove down to Louisiana and had my first TV there, and I didn't know anything what to do in a ring. I mean, it was, you know, didn't know how to wrestle. And, then I was, Crusher Darso down there. And as a baby face, I couldn't be a baby face. It was just really hard for me. So then he says, well, what we're going to do is we're going to make you a Russian and you're going to be partners with Nikolai Volkov and you're going to be hated by everybody. And then that's when it all started right there. That's when I kind of came out and, you know, really became a professional wrestler and felt comfortable. Oh, it's, you know, and then, you know, Terry Taylor helped me out a lot. George Weingroff, you know, all these guys down there, you know, I used to go to the town 2 hours early and go in the ring and wrestle. And I mean, that's how I learned.
I was going to ask you, you know, when they gave you the name Crusher Khrushchev and they were going to make you a Russian, I wonder what your thought was at that time, because I think, you know, a lot of us, you know, maybe the newer, you know, wrestling fans don't remember that, you know, in the 80s we had the Cold War with the Russians. So obviously the Russians were the bad guys back in the day. So, I mean, not just a heel. You guys were like the really the bad guys because you were the opposite, you know, the opposing country to the United States, you know, the two superpowers. So what was it like to be a Russian? And I just can imagine the heat you had at some of the arenas.
Well, you know, and back then everybody believed. I mean, it was unbelievable. When you came in the ring and you were a bad guy, you could make the people hate you. You could make them laugh. You could make them cry. I mean, you can control, you know, 10,000 people and make them do what you want them to do. And I remember Bill Watts saying to me, he says, Barry, you're going to be the worst hated heel in Mid-South wrestling. And he says, on the first interview you do, you're going to be the all-American boy that went to college, and you're going to hate America, and you're going to take this red shovel out, and you're going to look at Nikolai, and you're going to tell Nikolai that you're going to bury every American. And that was right there from then on. I couldn't even go anywhere without somebody wanting to fight me at a bar. People spitting my food in a restaurant. I had to fight my way out of the buildings. And back then it was like, now I'm doing my job. I'm a bad guy. You know what I mean?
What was it like working with Ivan and Nikita?
Oh, it was great. And I learned so much with Ivan, and you know, he was just unbelievable, a lot of fun to be around. And, you know, I traveled everywhere with Nikita and Ivan. And, you know, when you're in the Charlotte territory, you're on the road 7 days a week. And, you know, you go to the gym early in the morning, you go to the grocery store, pack a lunch, and you're driving for 6-7 hours. You get to the building, and you wrestle, and you get in the car, and you drive another 6-7 hours. I mean, it was, they were really good guys to be around.
Yeah, and I remember you guys were the six-man tag team champions, and I remember thinking back to that period, because I remember they never had belts for the six-man champions. You guys had a trophy, and I always thought,
you know,
if it was real, I mean, who would keep the trophy? You know, because
three different personalities,
you know.
That sucker was 5 feet tall, too. I mean, it was brutal to carry around.
Yeah.
I had the greatest life in the world.
Was that like the biggest title at that time that you had won? Was that six-man? Of course, I think you won, tag team champions in Florida?
Well, in Florida we were tag team champions, but down there I was the TV champion, United States champion, and Ivan and I were the world champions, and then we became the six-man champions.
You worked with Crockett until 87, and kind of after 87, that's when he started having some troubles with financial matters, and ultimately he would have to sell the promotion eventually to Ted Turner after, of course, he merged or bought out Bill Watts back in the day. When you left the Crocketts, could you kind of see the writing on the wall that this was a promotion really hurting and that it was getting towards the end of its run?
Well, yeah. In fact, the reason why I left, Crockett promised me so much money for the Great American Bash, and then he ended up screwing me out of the payday. And I'm the kind of guy that when I tell you something, I do it. And I expect everybody else, when they tell you something, they better do it. And I got in an argument with Crockett, and I told him, I said, well, if I don't get paid what you told me I'm going to get paid, I'm leaving. And he says, well, go ahead. So I left, and that's when Vince McMahon called me up. And it was the greatest move I ever made. But when the promoter starts screwing you out of money, you know they're hurting. And that was kind of the downfall starting. And at that time, you know, we were in jets and planes flying all over the country and, you know, living high in the hog. I was home almost every night. So you'd be in Chicago, you know, tomorrow night. Well, at 2 a.m, you'd be back home in Charlotte again because you're on a private jet flying home. And you knew that was, you know, how in the world can they afford to do this? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and obviously they couldn't because, you know, within a short time they were out of business.
Right. You know, and then all the big shots wanted to get on the jet and get home in 2 hours. Well, you know, me and Arn and Rock and Roll Express and the Midnight Express and all of us guys, we wanted to get on the slow plane. You know, because we drank beer and partied all the way back, and we didn't care if it took 6 hours, you know. I mean, we had more fun on the other plane than that jet.
Now, when you left Crockett, did you kind of already have a deal in place with WWE or at that time it would have been WWF, or was it that you felt when you left that, you know, you had, you know, made a name for yourself and that you wouldn't really have any problems getting into WWF?
No, I was, it was a little scary because at that time I had no job when I quit. The day I quit, I had nothing. And Earl Hebner, I was good friends with Earl, and I said, hey, Earl, can you do me a favor and call your brother David? Because David was up there, and he was a referee up there at that time. And I said, can you just kind of get me in contact with the WWF? And so Earl called up David. David talked to Vince. And it just so happened that they needed, you know, a 300-pound guy to be partners with Axe. And that's when Vince called me up and said, hey, Barry, he says, I'd like to meet with you if that's all right. You know, what's your schedule? You know, and I said, oh, Vince, I'm booked, you know, but I'll cancel. Whenever you want me up there, let me know, you know. And he says, well, I'd like to see you tomorrow morning. So, I got in a plane and a limo picked me up, and I was in Vince's office the next morning. What was crazy about it is, I had to sign a contract stating that I couldn't repeat what we talked about up there because of the gimmick and everything. So it was a real kind of a hush-hush deal when I went up there.
Now, I think a lot of fans that don't realize that Demolition Smash was originally going to be portrayed by Randy Cooley.
Yeah, Randy Cooley, yeah.
And what happened with him?
Well, you know, Randy's a great guy, and he was a heck of a wrestler, but he just didn't fit that character that Vince wanted. And, you know, they've watched me being Crusher Khrushchev and doing all that, and they just thought, you know, this might be a good fit. And they asked Bill Leedy, they said, Bill, would you mind if we brought Crusher Khrushchev up? And I met Bill way back when I first worked for Ole before I went to Mid-South and all that, when he was a mass superstar. So Bill says, oh, yeah, I'd love to have him come in, you know, and let's try him out and see what happens. And it just ended up clicking.
Yeah, I mean, that's I really loved you guys. That was one of my favorite tag teams growing up. And you think back to the 80s in the WWF, you had all those great, you had Strike Force and Hart Foundation, Killer Bees, Tully and Iron came in. You had, I mean, just like natural rivals with the Powers of Pain. And it was a very exciting period, you know, in WWF. And when they brought you in and they gave you this gimmick, you know, one of the criticisms, obviously, was that it seemed like it was a Road Warriors ripoff. And I remember in Road Warriors book, he talked about it, and he said, no, it was flattering that, you know, people would try to be something like us, that we inspired, you know, another tag team. So I was curious, when they gave you the gimmick and they pushed Demolition, did they kind of tell you they wanted you to be like the Road Warriors, or was the Road Warriors ever mentioned when you came into WWF?
They weren't even mentioned. It wasn't even, you know, in the thought. And, you know, I never even pictured us being like them, because, you know, the Road Warriors, when they became the Road Warriors, it was at a point where nobody worked like those guys. They came in and just beat people up. I mean, they kind of changed wrestling at that time. And, you know, when we did it, we wanted to be able to wrestle, you know, the Rockers, or, you know, smaller wrestlers and everything. We didn't just go beat them up. We actually wrestled and worked, where the Road Warriors worked a whole different way, you know. So, you know, to us, and, you know, and in fact, I've never even heard that we were Road Warrior ripoffs until almost I was done with wrestling. You know, that's why I kind of laugh about it. And, you know, I've talked to Joe about it and everything, and I said, yeah, I don't think we were anything like you guys. But then when we wrestled them, then it was a whole different ball game. It was kind of the same gimmick then when we actually wrestled them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I remember those comparisons, you know, back in the 80s. They would say, you know, you guys are like the Road Warriors. I guess obviously because you guys had your face painted, and there weren't that many wrestlers at that time that had their face painted.
See, and then we had a mask. We had a mask that we wore that we took off. And
right.
I mean, we were different. It'd be like saying the Warrior was like the Demolition when he came in.
Right.
He painted his face like we did.
I think one of the things that really made that gimmick work was the music, the theme music. And what was your reaction when you first heard the theme music?
Well, you know, it was Jimmy Hart. You know, is a genius. And he got together with Rick Derringer, and then they came up with that. And he had, you know, different things that, you know, he kind of ran across with us. And, you know, and we didn't know what it was going to sound like, but he kept telling me, he says, Barry, this is going to be good. And when I heard it, I just went, wow, that's us, you know.
Yeah.
So it was good.
I still think it's one of the best theme songs of all time.
Yeah, I do too. And,
yeah.
I do indie shows, and they play that music coming out, and I look at Bill and we just kind of laugh, you know. And, yeah, it was good.
I mean, here comes the Axe, here comes the Smasher. It's just like, you know, it's just one of those themes you just never forget, and you never get tired of hearing. I guess it's kind of like Real American.
Yeah.
I mean, when you hear it, you automatically know Hulk Hogan, you know, and just when I hear that song,
right.
You know, I think of you guys
yeah.
coming out with your mask, and you pull the masks off, and you guys are ready to kick somebody's teeth down their throat, you know, that's just...
yeah.
One of those great... I'm wondering, too, with Demolition, who's brainchild was it?
Bill Eadie came up with it. Bill Eadie and Randy Cauley. And they came up to it and told Vince about it, and Vince loved it.
And as I recall, after Bill Eadie left, there was some dispute over the rights of the name, correct?
Right, and he ended up suing Vince, and Vince settled with him, so he owns the name Axe, the Demolition Act.
And did you own the name Demolition Smash then?
No, I don't. I never had a lawsuit with Vince. Always got along with Vince. You know, he was the boss, respected him, and, you know, didn't like all of his choices that he made, but he was the boss. So I've never pursued trying to own the name or anything. When I left there, Vince just said to me, he goes, "Barry, you can do whatever you need to do." He said, "Just don't use the name Demolition Smash and go into a big promotion and be that." So what he was saying is, don't go to, WCW and be Demolition Smash. You know, or, you know what I mean?
Right. And that's interesting, because we've seen Vince have disputes over names. In fact, I just talked to China, and of course, after she left, she couldn't use that name China. She was in a legal battle with Vince to get the name China. So that's good. I think that's good that, he said, this is a gimmick that everybody knows, Demolition. So if you want to use it, and just don't use it in a bigger promotion. I think that was a classy move by Vince McMahon.
Well, yeah, and that's why I can't be upset at him. I mean, he's done me right, and I got dolls that are out there, and I get paid from them, and, I get a quarterly check, and sometimes it ain't very much, but, I go out and do autograph sessions, is Demolition Smash, and, he does, as long as you're not going to abuse it, and, I don't want to make 10,000 T-shirts and sell them on the web, that would be wrong, because then he should get paid, But if I go to a town and sell a T-shirt for $20 here and there, I mean, he's kind of got to look at it and go, hey, good for him. You know what I mean? That's how I've always been with him,
So
but now, but now other people are running the show now, and, they could say, hey, Barry, don't use that anymore. You know what I mean? But I've never done anything to anybody or spoke bad about anything, so I don't think they would do that.
How many shows do you work a year as Demolition? And I guess, how does it feel to still use that gimmick that was so popular in the 80s?
Well, it's kind of, I go out for fun right now, and I don't take all the bookings that I go on. I, kind of handpick them. And Bill and I go out maybe once a month, and mostly what we do is some autograph sessions. Don't get in the ring very often, but, it's fun to see the new guys and be in the dressing room with the guys that are starting to come up, and, you get to see your friends on the road every once in a while, and, that's kind of why I do it.
When Bill couldn't wrestle anymore, when he stepped down, he got injured, they brought in Crush, Brian Adams. What was your thought then? Did you kind of think that maybe you'd lose some luster going from, Axe and Smash to Smash and Crush?
Oh, definitely. I knew it was going to be, not the same. You can never replace something that's really good. You know what I mean? And Crush was the greatest guy, and we were, became best friends and everything. We traveled together. But, Crush was a young guy in the business, and it was great to get him up there and be partners with him and, get him into the business, and, but it was over his head at that time. And people don't realize that when you get to the WWF or the WWE right now, there's a lot of pressure on you, and you have to know what you're doing and when you're doing it. And it's not as easy as what it appears to be. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's a pretty high pressure situation, and he did a great job, but it just, he needed 3, 4, 5 years before he became Crush.
It just wasn't the same team, and that's what it came down
to.
Oh,
it wasn't the same team. And,
right.
you know, Bill and I talk about it a lot, and, you know, I love Bill. He's a great guy, and he is really smart in this business. And between him and Fuji, you know, I was, you know, 25, 26 years old when I went to the WWF. I was the young guy in the territory, and being 25 years old in the WWF at that time, you really are the young, you know, they called me the young boy, you know, and, you know, you're in a territory with, you know, Andre the Giant, Don Morocco, Jimmy Snuka, you know, Paul Orndorff, you know, these are guys that I used to watch when I was first getting in the business, and, you know, these guys are in their prime now, and here I'm a young kid coming up here getting that same position that Crush had. But, you know, I was already in the business 4 or 5 years, so I was, you know, pretty seasoned already. But, you know, you learn so much every match you have, and when you're wrestling guys that have been top guys in every one of the territories, and all of a sudden you're working with them, it just brings your work up. You know what I mean? It makes you that much better. And what's missing now is the young guys come in. They're not wrestling 4 and 5 years in all the different towns with guys that can work. They're wrestling guys on the indie shows that think they can work and think they can put on a show. You know, so it's different now when you go to the WWE and these guys that have been around for a long time, it's hard to keep up with them. It'd be tough to be in the business now.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to Sean Oliver the other day from Kayfabe Commentaries, and we were just talking about the mentality is so much different because, like you said, you know, back in the day, you would go from Florida to Chicago to St. Louis, you know, out west, northeast,
yeah.
And then you get all these experiences, and then when you would be on a big time show, you were a seasoned wrestler. You had different
yeah.
gimmicks, and you had a persona and you had a following, and now like you said, the kids today, the developmental system is they sign somebody, maybe he's got a good look, maybe he's got a good move here or there, they send you down to Florida and they say, you know, get ready in about 6 months, we'll bring you to television, and it's like so many
right.
of these guys are just so green, and they just like you said, you know, going back to like Bryan Adams, he just wasn't ready, and I see so many guys they do have on WWE television that just clearly aren't ready to be, you know, a big time wrestler.
Right, exactly. But they, after being on the road and being around these guys, it doesn't take them long, and then they are ready, you know. But they move them so fast to get into a position because you have to perform that, you know, these guys are pressure. I mean, you know, a perfect example, when CM Punk first came into the WWE, I remember I was watching him and watching my kid, and I said, you know, what in the world are they doing with this guy? He ain't ready for this. He's terrible. And then, you know, 6 months later, I saw him. I thought, you know, this guy might be something, you know. And look at him now.
Yeah.
You know?
The hottest guy in wrestling right now.
He's unbelievable. but, you know, Vince and the whole group that, you know, he has around them, they see something in somebody, and when they, you know, put all that time and effort into them, they know that this guy is going to make it one day, and he has. And, you know, good for you, CM Punk, you know?
Yeah, I think CM Punk's a little bit different in that, you know, we're talking about territories. I mean, he was in Ring of Honor for a long time, got to wrestle in front of, you know, good-sized crowds, got a following. So when he went to WWE, he had some experience where, like, again, some of the guys they call it from Florida Championship Wrestling, I've only been in wrestling 6 months,
right.
a year, two but, years, and they're clearly not ready, you know. They haven't wrestled half a number of matches that the other guys
yeah.
have wrestled.
But when CM Punk first went in there, it looked like he didn't fit. You know what I mean? It just,
yeah. I mean, that's a knock like against, like, Bryan Daniel. You know, he's Bryan
right.
Danielson. You know, it's like, you know, he's a Ring of Honor guy, and they've had, like, Evan Bourne's another guy. Guys they have it from Ring of Honor that, you know, doesn't fit, but you just got to give them the right, I guess, the right gimmick or the right storyline to really let them show what they can do.
Exactly, and they're good
you
enough
know?
That they can do it. And then because the Ring of Honor, when you're in that Ring of Honor, those guys are great in the Ring of Honor.
Yes.
But you bring him to another venue, and then it's a whole different ballgame. It was like when the WWF and WCW were going at it. The top guy from WCW could go to the WWF or WWE and wouldn't be the top guy in the WWF.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was just,
yeah.
It's a whole different ballgame getting up into that league. And it's like the guys from the WWE now can go to TNA and they can be somebody, but a guy from TNA going to WWE, it's just a whole different situation, you know?
Going back to WWE, are you under a Legends contract with WWE?
No, I never signed a Legends contract.
Okay. And, you know, well, WWE also, I mean, have you really given any thought to the Hall of Fame? Because, you know, every year we talk about some of the legends that are, you know, as a possibility for the Hall of Fame. Is that something that would be like a crowning jewel in your career if Vince calls you and said, hey, you know, come on up to where we are for WrestleMania, we're going to put you in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, it'd be huge. You know, I kind of laugh sometimes. You know, you see the guys that become that are in the Hall of Fame, and I go, how in the world did he get in the Hall of Fame? You know, what has he done? You know,
yeah, right.
And I just, you know, you just kind of get a kick out of it because, you know, what have they done? You know, and I don't talk about everything that I've done, and you know, it's like who's Barry Darso, you know. But when you look at everything that I've done, you go, holy cow, this guy should be in the Hall of Fame. But, you know, I suppose if I was going to get in there, it would be because of the demolition.
Sure.
And then you look at all the other tag teams throughout all of the years, you know, there's so many good tag teams. So, you know, I mean, it would be a heck of it'd be an honor, you know.
Yeah, while you mentioned tag teams, obviously, you know, I grew up in the 80s and we watched a lot of the tag teams, you know, Rock and Roll, Midnight, the Horsemen, you know, we were talking about WWE teams, the Killer Bees, Heart Foundation, et cetera. And what's your thought of today? Because obviously the mentality is tag team wrestlings don't draw. They're not main event type level, acts. Do you think they're kind of missing out? Because I think there's so many really good tag team wrestlers out there, and yet, like I said, the mentality is, you know, tag team wrestling doesn't draw anymore.
Well, it doesn't draw because they don't have them.
Sure.
I mean, that's why they don't draw. They can say, hey, tag teams don't draw. Well, of course they don't because you don't have them.
They split them up in 6 months, you know?
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of the reason why they don't have them is because it's hard for a single match to follow a tag team match. And the tag team match, you have four guys in there, and in a regular match, you only have two. So to build two guys up as a tag team, it takes a long time to get the tag team over, where in a single match, you can get a guy over a lot faster. And I think that they should just have the tag team on there because it gives an exciting time in the match, especially on the house shows. You know, if you're in the Omni or if you're in, you know, Madison Square Gardens, it's a different match than a single match. And when you put two guys together that are two top single matches and against two other top single guys and put them in a tag, they don't gel like a tag team does. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're getting four single guys over at the same time. That's one of the reasons why they do it.
Yep. And again, you know, going back to the 80s, you know, with the thought I had there was, you know, some of the tag teams they had in the 80s, they had been together for so long, and they, again, went from territory to territory to territory. I remember the Killer Bees, they were, you know, in different territories. Obviously, the Rockers came up together. Central States, I remember they were, you know, wrestling in. So, and then again, today is, you know, they throw two guys together for, you know, a short run, and then within a couple months, they're feuding with each other. So,
right.
So the mentality is so different.
Yeah, but what they're doing right now must be working because, you know, people are still watching wrestling, and you know, ratings are good. Their pay-per-views are great. So, you know, without the tags, I guess it's working.
Do you?
But I don't. I can't see how they can say a tag team doesn't draw because, you know, it does draw.
Right. Do you are you a fan of WWE and TNA today? And do you watch the shows currently?
You know, I am. You know, I don't watch very often, but when I do, you know, it's kind of hard for me to watch because it's, you know, I would do things different than what I see on there. But, you know, I've asked for a job up in the WWE for a long time and I gave up. You know, I wanted to be an agent or help on the booking committee or whatever. And, you know, they don't want a washed up old wrestler anymore. They would rather have a movie guy come in or a TV guy to do, you know, to tell them how to wrestle, you know. It's they don't like wrestlers.
Yeah, they want soap operators nowadays.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And but you know, I like watching it because a lot of my friends are still on there, and you know that's why I would watch it, is because of my old friends, you know. And then now Dakota's getting in, so it's kind of like I want to be up on it so I can, you know, critique him and knock him, you know. he's learned not to say, "Dad, how'd I do?" You know, because even if he does great, I still got to tell him what he did wrong.
Right. After you were in Demolition, they gave you a new gimmick, the Repo Man. I guess, what was your thought when they gave you that gimmick? I mean, coming from Demolition, where you had a lot of success, and they gave you this new gimmick, and who came up with that gimmick?
I came up with the gimmick, and I really loved it. And what it was supposed to do was end up becoming a big baby face. And I knew it was kind of getting towards the end of my career, you know, and it was time for me to be able to go to, you know, Make-A-Wish and, you know, all these different outlets to see, you know, help kids and help, you know, just different programs. And I thought it was really going to work good once I turned babyface, and they never did. And that was one of the reasons why I quit there, is because they weren't going to change me babyface. And when I started off, you know, wrestling Randy Savage and Jim Duggan and Slaughter and, you know, all the top guys.
Mm-hmm.
And right after that was when I was supposed to turn babyface. And then it just dragged on too long and got to be where I wasn't important anymore. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I didn't like it anymore. So the thought was there was to become a babyface. And then and it was a character that kids would have loved because, you know, the first thing I did was stole the kid's bike, you know, on
right.
TV.
Right.
And so then all the kids hated me. And then once they hate you so bad, and then all of a sudden you turn good, then they love you even more. And that was the thought. So it kind of backfired a little bit.
Some great memories thinking back to that period, because it was such a hot period, you know, going back to, you know, late 80s. I was thinking back to WrestleMania when you guys were Demolition and winning the tag titles and you had the long run, and then You were Repo Man, and then, as you were saying, you left WWF at that time, and then you went back to, not really went back to WCW, because it was not WCW when it was the Crockett's, when you worked with the Crockett's, but then you went to WCW, and how did that come about?
Well, I when I came back here, you know, I've been best friends with Arn Anderson forever. I love him. And he started working in the office down there in WCW. And I called up Arn and I said, "Arn, I want to get a job down here. Is it worth it?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah, you got to come down here." Well, you know, I've met Eric Bischoff before, and I called up Eric and said, "Hey, Eric, I want to come in here." So when I went in there, he said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I'll do anything, whatever you want me to do." And he says, "Well, come up with some kind of a gimmick." And Flair was the booker then at the time, and I asked Rick, and he said, "Yeah, it's something that's real rugged and rough and tough, you know." And so Arn and I were at Bobby Eaton's garage. We were drinking a beer, And I said, Arn, they want me to kind of be a truck driver. What would my name be? And after about 5-6 beers, he put his wire rim glasses down below his nose, and he looked at me, and he says, you're the blacktop bully. And I said, I love it. So then I loved that gimmick. I mean, that was my favorite gimmick.
Really?
It was going real strong, and we had that pay-per-view, me and Dustin, that truck match, and I thought, oh, this is my time. I'm going to have a hell of a run here now. Well, then that night, Eric Bischoff called me at home, and he says, Barry, I got some bad news for you, and he says, I got to fire you tonight. I said, you're kidding me. I said, we just had the best match of our life. He says, yeah, you guys were bleeding in the truck, and we weren't supposed to have any blood. And I said, well, Eric, I said, I got nailed into the fence, got hit by barbed wire, got hit with a, you know, can. My back was bleeding. My arms are bleeding. My head, I said, I had no choice. And he says, well, just do me a favor. And he said, just leave on good terms, and I'll bring you back. And I said, Eric, you know, we're friends. I said, whatever you need me to do, I'll do. So I went home for about 6 months, and Eric called me up. He goes, Barry, he says, come on back. I'm going to hire you back. So then he hired me back. And next thing I know, I'm, a golfer, and, you know, they don't want to push you because now the NWO is going and all this other stuff's going. But I ended up working maybe 3 days a month, and I had the best contract I ever had in my life. You know, so I love Eric Bischoff. He took care of me. You know, it's all about the money.
I think so many of those guys back in the day, you know, from that era, you know, they went to WCW. Obviously, Vince was, or Eric was, you know, handing out the money, and he was very attracted, I think, to former WWF stars. So he brought a lot of them in. And then obviously, as you were saying, NWO took off with Hall and Nash and Hogan. And I guess, what was it like to be, you know, in WCW at that time? Because, I mean, NWA came along, it was like a revolution in wrestling again.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, if you're a top guy and you're not one of them, you sure don't want to be in the territory. Because there ain't no way you're going to ever get any, you know, good publicity or anything. But I was looking at it where I wrestled maybe 25 times in a year, and, you know, I made $150,000 for 25 times. I mean, that's the best money I ever made in my life.
And again, you know, like you were saying, how the Crocketts were spending the money, you know, back in the day. Now WCW was going in the same direction where they were spending a lot of money, and at the end, they didn't have any money. I mean, they just ran out of money, you know.
And then I went down to $75,000, and I wrestled probably 10 times.
And didn't they have Lanny Poffo under contract, and he never wrestled one match?
Yeah.
I mean, what a deal, huh?
But you know what's funny is I call all the time, am I a TV? You know, because I wanted to work. And I was used to working for $25 and $50 in half the towns you wrestle in, you know, from way back. And all of a sudden you're making this money and not working, and it's like, you know, you just felt, you know, I mean, being from the old school, you feel bad about not, you know, working for your money, you know. And, then they, you know, bring Goldberg up, and Eric says, hey, you know, help Goldberg out, you know, help him, you know, teach him how to wrestle and this and that. And I thought, well, now I'm going to earn my keep, you know, get in there with Goldberg and have him beat you up for a while, you know. So then there wasn't enough money that they paid me, you know. Goldberg was just the greatest guy. He's just a super, super nice guy.
As I kind of recall, like towards the end of your stint there with WCW, working on the Saturday Night Show, and obviously that was kind of like the C show. Did that kind of feel like they don't want you for Nitro, and they don't want you to Thunder, so they put you on Saturday Night?
Well, you know, I never looked at it that way, you know, because I was reality, you know. You can see where you're at, and if you don't like it, you leave. And, you know, when you're getting a paycheck and doing what you're doing, you know, if you're on the C show and you get beat, then less people see you.
Sure. That's true.
You get that way, right?
Right.
Shoot, you're on the number one show and you get beat, then it's everybody in the world sees you.
What was it like going back to the Raw show back in 2007 when you were at the 15th anniversary Battle Royal and you were once again the Repo Man?
Yeah, that was fun. Howard Finkel called me up at my office. He says, Barry, he says, we're going to bring back the Repo Man, you know. He says, can you make it? I said, gosh, Howard, I can't. I said, I'm working all the time. I just can't get away. And he says, hey, you know, he named all the guys on the card, and he says, please come back. And I said, all right, you know, and I was really happy. You know, Howard was, I was good friends with Howard Finkel for a long time, and it was good to, you know, because I was away from the business for so long, it was just good to get back and see everybody. And, you know, I talked to Linda McMahon and Vince and Shane, and, you know, it was fun to see everybody again. Undertaker.
You know, since the time that you've left WWF and you've gone into different ventures, kind of talk about what you do outside of wrestling.
An old buddy of mine, we got together and we started a print company. We bought a very expensive pad printing machine and we started in his garage. And we had the idea of printing on hard hats. And so we print logos on hard hats, and then it ended up getting to be where we left the garage and went to a bigger building, and then we started printing on safety vests and medical parts and, you know, all different plastic parts. And then we outgrew that, and now we're in a 8,500-square-foot building, and we print signs. We got automatic screen printing machines. We got four-pad printing machines, and we have five employees and two or three part-time employees. So that's kind of where I spend my life now is at work. And, you know, it's added value printing. And it's pretty exciting to start something in the worst economy, the worst time, and be able to build it up. And, you know, we think it's going to be very successful.
Congratulations on that. As you said, well, you know, this is – one of the worst economic periods we've had in decades. So it's good that your business is successful in this very hard times.
Yeah, well, you know, we got a long ways to go. You know, we went 4 years, I didn't take a paycheck. And we're into our fifth year now. And finally we're starting to, you know, be able to, you know, pay bills and everything. But all of our equipment in the company is all paid for and everything. And now I just like to, you know, see my kid make it in wrestling. And, you know, I told him 5 years ago, I said, do not get into wrestling, finish school. And he got his associate's degree, and he called me one day, and he said, Dad, I'm getting into wrestling. And I said, well, you promised me you're getting your four-year degree. And he says, well, I got to take a break. So Lanny Lane helped train him, and I helped train him, and then he signed a contract with the WWE and went down to Florida and was under contract with them. And then they let him go and told him, you know, hey, just get out and, you know, wrestle. And, you know, he was only 21, 22 years old. So, you know, it's pretty young to be in wrestling. And now he's at Nasty Knob School. He's helped training guys. And he had his debut on TNA about a month ago. And, you know, he's hoping to get a job with them. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, you know, it was odd. I remember when they released him, so I thought that was, you know, they have been really keen on second-generation wrestlers. You know, you got Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo's, you know, kids. You got, you know, DiBiase's kids on the main roster along with Dusty Rhodes's kid. And you've got,
yeah,
you know, Superfly Snuka's daughter and had his son there for a while. And I guess what happened there, because, you know, it seemed like it was kind of a natural fit. They were obviously looking for second-generation wrestlers, and, you know, why didn't it work out at that time?
Well, I think what it is, you know, like I say, he was 22 years old. He's a young kid. And, you know, he's in the ring with guys that are 6'5 and 6'4, just monster guys down there in Florida Championship Wrestling. And he's more of a worker and, you know, an old school wrestler, and he can wrestle the new way now too. But there were so many second generation guys, it's almost a bad thing. because you can't have all those second generation guys on TV in the WWE. Otherwise, it turns into the old way of wrestling. So, you know, they wanted to get him out of there and get some experience, and then after he gets experience, then come back. And, you know, they told him, they said, you know, in a few years, come back and you'll be ready to go. So, you know, he's just been hitting the indie circuit. And like I say, he's at Knobs' school all the time, you know, now training guys instead of being trained. And, you know, a few guys that have been in the business a long time go down there, and then he's working with guys that are better. And, you know, now with TNA, if he can get a job with those guys, that'll be huge. And I think he does have a really good chance of being good. You know, it's just if he can get that right push in the right situation, because he can do anything, you know. Good talker, can work in the ring. It's just he's got to get a chance.
Dad is talking
well.
I'm not
just saying it. Well, right? Yeah, and I'm not just saying it because he's my kid either. I'm probably harder on him than anybody, and, you know, I tell him, you know, hey, that looked terrible, that's bad, you know, and lately I haven't been able to say that. This last year, it's more like, whew, you know, you're looking good, kid, keep it up. You know what I mean?
Right.
So.
Looking back at your career, do you have any regrets?
You know, I really don't. Like I told you earlier, I've had the greatest life in the world. I've done it all. I've been to every city all over the world. I've met the greatest guys. I guess one regret was, you know, for about 10 years, 15 years, I couldn't really talk to fans. I was the bad guy. And I always believed when you're the bad guy, you don't want to be friends with the fans because you want them to hate you.
Right.
If they hate you in real life, they'll hate you when you're performing. And, you know, now I do autograph sessions. I mean, it's great to see all these fans. And I guess, you know, being the bad guy for so long, you missed out on a lot of that stuff. But, you know, I guess I really don't have regrets, though.
What's the best rib somebody played on you?
I never really got ribbed, you know. I was with the master of all ribbers, so it kind of protected me.
That's good.
I was with Master Fuji.
Ah, yes.
I've heard some stories
about him. So
just being around Fuji, it was kind of like if they ribbed me, they ribbed Fuji, and you didn't want to get ribbed back by Fuji.
True. How many more years do you think you want to be in the ring and actually wrestling?
I don't want to be. I heard. You know, you can't, when I go in the ring, you can't even call it wrestling. I mean, now I think, you know, when you go to an indie show and they have, you know, Axe and Smash, the Demolition's going to be versus this, they really don't want to see us wrestle. They want to just see you in the ring and, you know, do a couple of things and, you know, that's the end of it because they know you can't wrestle anymore. You know what I mean?
How does Bill still do it? How does he get in there anymore, you know, after all these years?
I don't know. He's just a machine. We just sit and laugh. And the funny thing is every time, you know, we get in the ring, somehow one of the guys, you know, grabs my arm and takes me down or something. You know, and I always look at Bill and I go, yeah, it's another fine mess you got me into now. And then, you know, when he's in there doing it, he looks over at me and it's the same thing. It's like, what in the world are we doing? But, you know, it's fun just goofing around, you know. But it's not serious like it was. And it's hard to go in there and do it when you can't be 100%. But, you know, you kind of just do it just for the fans to enjoy it, hopefully.
Now, one thing that's popular is wrestling books, and we just talked about, you know, Road Warrior Animals book. Have you ever thought about writing a book about your career?
Yeah, I have. I think it would be a good storytelling book where I would tell all good things in there that have happened to me and with all the people that I met. And it'd be some pretty good stories. But, everybody's had books and, you know, the more books that get out there, the less sell. you know, and when you haven't been on TV forever, people don't know you anymore, and, you know, it's, I don't know. I think if I wrote it, it would be for my own enjoyment, you know.
Maybe when Vince
Would you buy a book?
I would. I'm talking to you right now, and I got like a million questions more for you, and I've already talked to you for an hour, and it's just like, you gotta have, I mean, I haven't even like asked you any like road stories. I mean, I just think you guys are on the road, you're in this city, you're in that city, the fans, you went to Japan. I mean, you had a great career, and I think it would be a very interesting read. I'd like to see you do it at some point.
Well, you know, and just, you know, some of the stories are just unbelievable. I mean, riding with superstar Billy Graham, you know, and watching how he eats and trains, and, you know, there's so many of them, you know, playing cribbage with Andre the Giant and watching him get mad at you, you know, and hoping he doesn't take it out on you in the ring, you know, and it just, there's a million stories. I don't even know if I can, the book would be too heavy to carry around. There'd be so many stories.
That's like with Bret Hart. I mean, he wrote so many pages, they said, you know, put it into a second volume. I mean, you know, it's like.
Yeah.
You had such great stories, you know, write them down, and then obviously you go to an editor, and they're gonna edit it down anyways, but, you know, recall some of the great moments you've had. I mean, some of the WrestleMania experiences, I think that would be tremendous, and some of the WCW pay-per-views you were on, and, you know, I think it'd be a tremendous book. I'd like to see maybe one of the publishers give you a call, and maybe you'll get a chance to do it at some point.
Yeah, if somebody called and kind of twisted my arm, maybe I might do one, but, you know, it's a lot of work, you know, and
yes.
I, like I say, I'm already working all the time, so it's kind of tough.
Yep, and at that stage too, it's, you know, you are a busy guy, and you're working this making this business work, and that's great, and we do appreciate your time tonight, Barry. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and like I said, I could ask you a million more questions, but who knows, maybe at some point we'll have you know back on and maybe do some of those road stories. I, you know, I'm always intrigued by. You know, some of the things that we didn't get a chance to see, you know, we watched wrestling, but there were so many things that were going on behind the scenes that we didn't get a chance to see or hear about. So I think that would be, like I said, that's where our book would come in perfectly. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, give me a call anytime. But
before we wrap with you, why don't you go ahead and plug your website for your business and your wrestling website. And if you want to talk about the social media as well, go ahead.
Okay, well, my company is addedvalueprinting.com, and if anybody needs to get a hold of me, they can go to, you know, barrydarsowrestling.com, and, you know, a lot of people have been sending, you know, pictures and stuff with envelopes to send back, where, you know, I just sign them at my office, but, you know, I'm going to be in Atlanta coming up here August 6th. And then on the 12th, I'm in Chicago at a flea market down south of Chicago. I don't know what town it is. But I hope to see all the fans there. It'd be huge.
Great. And, you know, just keep us abreast of your schedule, and we'll definitely plug it at gerwick.net. And also, Barry is on Twitter, correct?
Yep, on Twitter. I'm on Twitter. I'm trying to learn how to do the Twitter deal. But, you know, us old-timers, you know how that is.
So if you
tweet me. Is that how you say it? You tweet me?
Yeah, tweet
or,
you.
Or do I tweet you?
Yeah, well, you could, they tweet you, and then you tweet back.
Okay. Well, if I don't tweet back, it's not because I don't want to. It's because I don't know how.
and Barry at Twitter is at Real Demo Smash. So if you
Real
tweet
Demo
up there.
Smash.
Yeah, Real Demo Smash if you want to. Tweet Barry, and then you never know, maybe Barry will tweet you back. All right, Barry, we appreciate your time tonight. It's been a pleasure, and you know, continue success, and we'll look forward to talking to you in the future.
Steve, I appreciate the phone call, and I got to thank all the fans for watching for all the years, and keep watching. And watch my kid, and tweet him, too.
Yeah, he's on Twitter as well.
Yeah, he's on Twitter as well, and push for him at TNA Wrestling.
Yeah, Dakota Darso, and then send the tweet to Dixie Carter and Jeff Jarrett down there and tell them you want to see Dakota Darso in TNA.
Yeah, you'll love him. You'll love him. He'll be quite the entertainer.